From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, January 16th, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And by Douglas Ridge, a new eco-conservation subdivision in Brunswick, dedicated to nature-centric sustainable home design. More at douglasridge.com.
Maine saw a record number of tick-borne diseases last year. The Maine Center for Disease Control says 2019 had the highest number of cases of Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. And the numbers may continue to climb as more reports come in. Patty White has more.
Lyme disease tops the list with 2,079 cases last year. Numbers of the disease have never broken 2,000 in the past. Anaplasmosis also saw an all-time high of 685 cases, as did babesiosis with 138 cases. The director of the Maine CDC, Dr. Nirav Shah, says it's too early to speculate why the numbers are so high. But the increase emphasizes the importance of preventing bites from deer ticks by wearing repellent and protective clothing and doing daily tick checks. Shah also notes that ticks aren't just a seasonal threat. They can be active anytime temperatures rise above 40 degrees. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
1,400 acres of forest land near Sebago Lake have been permanently protected through a purchase facilitated by the Trust for Public Land. The Trust Director for Maine, Betsy Cook, says the Tiger Hill Community Forest will benefit the local community and protect the quality of Sebago Lake, which serves as the water supply for the greater Portland region. The Portland Water District actually contributed $345,000 of the $1.6 million project cost.
My understanding is because there are so many wetlands, so many streams on this property, and because the Northwest River runs right next to it, all of those streams and the river flow into Sebago Lake. And so by protecting kind of the upstream forest, you're actually having a huge impact on the quality of the lake.
Cook says efforts to protect the land gained momentum a year and a half ago when the property was listed for sale, bringing fears it could be developed. She says the ultimate goal of a collaboration called Sebago Clean Waters is to conserve an additional 33,000 acres and that the 1,400-acre Tiger Hill Community Forest is a critical milestone. And the state of Maine is allowing 9 new people to fish for elvers in the coming season. The baby eels were worth more than $2,300 a pound in Maine in 2018. The Maine Department of Marine Resources will accept applications for the Elver Lottery from today until February 21st. In weather tonight, snow ending, becoming very cold overnight with lows 6 below north to the mid-teens above in the south. Tomorrow, partly cloudy north in mountains, otherwise sunny and very windy. Maine's Public Utilities Commission is opening an investigation into CMP's winter disconnection policies. That's after a Central Maine Power notice to a customer this month claimed that electricity service could be disconnected without express approval from the commission. Fred Bever reports in most cases, CMP is barred from such winter disconnections.
Rockland resident Faith Dean says she received what appeared to be a hand-delivered document from CMP in her mailbox on Wednesday. The mailer says that to avoid disconnection, the recipient should call CMP. At the bottom, it says, "If you fail to contact us, we can disconnect your services during the winter months without approval of the PUC.
It is really terrifying, you know, to come home after work and think, you know, gee, we're about ready. We're in the middle of winter. We're going to get a huge snowstorm tomorrow. I've got two little kids, and now they're threatening to disconnect my electricity without any approval. I mean, it's a horrible feeling."
The PUC's rules expressly bar utility disconnections from November through the end of March without formal approval from the commission in almost all cases. But a CMP spokeswoman says that when the company makes repeated attempts to contact a customer who is in arrears, and when a company representative also visits the site and deems it to be unoccupied, a winter disconnection can go ahead without PUC approval. PUC spokesman Harry Lanfear says there must be evidence, such as uncollected mail, unplowed snow, a lack of cars in the driveway, or other signs of abandonment.
That's when they can disconnect. And then if they disconnect and somebody's really there, they have to reconnect immediately because, again, if it's occupied, it requires our approval.
The mailer customer Faith Dean says she received this week makes no mention of whether the premises had been deemed unoccupied. She acknowledges her household is in arrears and that she has been out of touch with CMP for months, but she adds she and her family definitely live there, with four cars on the lot. CMP says since November 15th, it served 1,000 customers with notices of potential disconnection. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The 2020 elections won't just be about the race for the White House or Congress or the Maine legislature. They'll also be about vaccinations for school children and potentially whether Central Maine Power should be able to build a $1 billion power line that helps Massachusetts meet its renewable energy goals. The campaigns for both issues are well underway, and so is the spending that's designed to persuade Maine voters. We brought in Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler for some analysis. Steve, yesterday was the reporting deadline for these ballot campaigns, but there is a big difference between them. One's definitely going to be decided by Maine voters in March, and the other one could be in November, right?
Yeah, Nora, that's exactly right. The definite one is actually a people's veto campaign, and it's the one that could overturn a law that the legislature passed last year that would eliminate most exemptions from a law requiring kids to get vaccinated before they can attend school. Prior to last year's law, parents could obtain exemptions for medical conditions or because of religious or philosophical objections. The new law eliminates the religious and philosophical objections, but keeps the medical exemptions. And it's been controversial from the get-go and ultimately prompted opponents to organize and force what's called a people's veto. That means voters will decide whether to overturn that law at the ballot box in an election that takes place in March. And that's the exact same day that Democrats will be holding their presidential primary. And now the other one is a potential referendum that could scuttle CMP's power line proposal. That referendum isn't certified yet. Opponents of the project are still collecting signatures and trying to get on the ballot. And if they're successful, that referendum will be held in November, along with all the candidate contests you had previously mentioned.
Okay, so one people's veto on vaccines and one possible referendum on CMP's power line proposal. Isn't it a little early to focus on a campaign that may never actually happen?
Yeah, normally it is, but the transmission project is so high profile and so controversial that all the players are assuming that a referendum is a certainty, and they're certainly spending like it too.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of digital and TV advertising by a group called, Clean Energy Matters, advocating for the project. I am assuming that is reflected in these reports.
Yeah, it sure is. So the group Clean Energy Matters is basically the ballot question committee representing Central Maine Power, or CMP, but it's using a different name, and I don't think that's an accident. As you know, Nora, CMP's brand has taken a hit in recent years because of reliability problems, billing issues, and requests for rate increases. So that's why the ballot campaign often doesn't mention CMP in its advertising. And that advertising on this project has been extensive, arguably relentless. The ballot committee raised $2.3 million over the last 3 months of 2019, and it spent nearly all of it to the tune of $24,000 a day between October and December. It's hired professional campaign staff and spending to place that advertising. And as we previously reported, Clean Energy Matters has spent a ton on polling that's really informing the messaging the campaign is using in this advertising blitz. And I'd be remiss not to mention another player in all of this, Hydro-Québec. That's the Canadian power company that would supply the power for the transmission project. They also have a ballot question committee, and they've spent over $200,000 on campaign staff and consultants. And as I reported earlier this week, that committee is also under the microscope because it was late disclosing its activity and because its mere involvement in a campaign in here in Maine has raised questions about foreign influence in an election.
There are groups who are spending against the project, though, right?
Yeah, there certainly are. Perhaps the most familiar group is No CMP Corridor, which bills itself as a grassroots opposition campaign. And that group is leading the signature gathering effort to try to get this referendum on the ballot in November. Latest campaign finance reports show about $19,000 in cash contributions and roughly $50,000 from a separate group called Stop the Corridor. Now, Stop the Corridor is a bit of a mystery because it's refused to disclose its donors, and legally it doesn't have to, although Corridor supporters have no problem insinuating that the Stop the Corridor is basically funded by fossil fuel generators who see the corridor project as a threat to their business model.
So we're looking at $2.3 million being spent by this one group in favor of the corridor. And it looks like not as much being spent by the groups that are opposing it. Am I right there?
You're right. And I think one of the reasons for that, Nora, is that the groups that are opposing the corridor already have public opinion on their side. If you look at some of the votes that some of the communities where this line would pass through, I mean, they've been pretty lopsided in opposition to the corridor. And that's just a snapshot, I think, of the statewide perception of the corridor project as a whole. You know, remember, we're talking about a company that's got a lot of problems in terms of its brand, in terms of people and people's trust in that brand, and it's linked to this project. And so over time, maybe if CMP's advertising is successful in moving public opinion more in support of the corridor, maybe that spending discrepancy will even out over time. But right now, they don't have to spend as much money. And the other thing is, too, is that the anti-corridor group, while we don't know about the true nature of all of their donations, because that one group that has provided a lot of in-kind donation and loans is keeping its donors secret, a lot of the other donors to that group are truly grassroots donors. They are $5 checks, $10 checks, you know, very minimal amounts of money. And so they may not have as much money at the end of the day to level the playing field if CMP at some point actually tilts public opinion in its favor in support of this project.
All right. Thanks for breaking that down, Steve.
You're welcome.
And that was Steve Missler, Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent. When Almost Maine opened in Portland 16 years ago, the play was well received and would go to mixed reviews in New York a few years later. But today it is one of the most frequently produced plays in the United States, particularly in high school and community theaters. Almost Maine playwright John Cariani, who grew up in Presque Isle, joins the cast of the latest production at Portland Stage Company in celebration of Maine's bicentennial. Keith Shortall spoke with Cariani about the play's portrayal of rural people and real love lost and found.
Almost Maine, a fictitious town close to the Canadian border, is the setting for a series of vignettes that explore the joys and the pitfalls of relationships. In this scene, Cariani, as Lendl, answers the door to find his girlfriend Gail, played by Samantha Rosentrater.
I want it back.
Huh?
I want it back.
What?
All the love I gave to you, I want it back.
What?
Now.
These moments of pain and laughter, heartache and confusion, says John Cariani, were born from his interest in the subject of love, driven in part by his personal experience coming of age in the geographically isolated community of Presque Isle, Maine.
When I was growing up, I knew that I was a little bit different from the other kids, and I saw my friends like having girlfriends, and I couldn't figure out why I wasn't having a girlfriend. Or I did have girlfriends, but I couldn't figure out why I wasn't very happy having girlfriends. And then, of course, I figured out that I didn't like girls. You know what I mean? So,
Pete.
Yeah.
I love you.
And watching my brother fall head over heels in love with girls, I was like, okay, he's falling in love. I'm not. What's going on? And I wasn't ready to fall in love because I didn't know what I was and what love was going to be for me. So I was kind of obsessed with it, trying to figure out what it is and why it seems so easy for some people and so complicated for some people.
I love you too.
Almost Maine has now been performed in 20 countries, translated into more than a dozen languages, and according to Playbill magazine, is the most produced play in North American high schools, surpassing A Midsummer Night's Dream, Our Town, and The Crucible. The reason for its popularity, he says, may be its simple approach to exploring a universal human experience.
I think it's that people really like love stories, and especially fraught love stories that you're not quite sure are going to work out, not quite sure it's going to be okay, love stories that feel like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure this is the right thing for these people to be doing.
And is there something that happens in those moments when the audience is feeling uncomfortable about it that there's something funny about that as well?
Oh yeah, watching people in pain is the funniest thing in the world, unfortunately.
What? All the love you gave to me, it's in the truck.
What are you talking about?
I don't want it anymore.
What?
I've made a decision. We're done.
What?
We're done. I decided, and so I brought all the love you gave to me back to you. It is the right thing to do.
I don't understand what you're talking about.
It's in the truck.
Cariani, the playwright, says he's always been committed to bringing real rural characters who live and love as best they can to the stage.
Contemporary American art and culture doesn't really present multidimensional rural dwelling people. So that's my big question, is why don't we present these people? And when we do, why do we always present them as drug addicts only? Or supporters of a certain party only? Do you know what I mean? Political party. Why don't they have all of the foibles and all of the great things that make them fully human like we do when we present people who live in maybe urban areas?
What's it like?
What's what like?
To not feel pain.
I don't know. I don't know what it feels like to hurt, so I don't know.
Almost Maine, with playwright John Cariani in a starring role, runs through February 9th at Portland Stage Company. The play is soon to become a novel. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Keith Shortall.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for a conversation about the joys and challenges of co-parenting. I'm Nora Flaherty.